following is a PodcastOne.com presentation.
He's trained over 40,000 pets, served as the contributing pet editor of the Today Show for 15 years, and is the author of 11 animal behavior books. And now, Warren Eckstein is on Podcast One. Welcome to the Pet Insider.
Hello and welcome to the Pet Insider on Podcast One. I'm your host, Warren Eckstein. And if you love animals, care about wildlife and the environment, you have come to the right place. We'll be focusing on pet psychology, pet behavior, pet training, and everything that affects your pet's lifestyle. Special show coming up for you today, the Pet Survival, Pet Guardian Survival. And with me is a special guest, a good friend, someone I've known for many, many years right now, an amazing trainer and also an amazing person in general. We'll talk about her rescue work with greyhounds later. But with me in the studio is Jeannie Tuttle. Jeannie is a certified professional dog trainer, certified nose work instructor, a full member of the dog training professional recognized by the Pet Professional Guild, an association for force-free pet professionals. That's why I love her. And a professional member of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers. And Jeannie's been training for over 25 years, and she launched her own business in 2003, specializing in teaching people how to successfully use positive communication techniques with their dogs for a lifetime of happiness and understanding. Jeannie, welcome to the Pet Insider.
Thanks for having me, Warren. I'm excited to be here.
It's my pleasure. First of all, I love that you're here. The fact that, and Nikki's with us. We'll talk about Nikki later. Nikki is a rescued greyhound that is kind of snoozing in the background. You know, when it comes to dogs that wind up at shelters and dogs that wind up with humane societies and rescues or out on the street, almost 80% of these dogs wind up at the shelter specifically for behavioral reasons, whether it be so-called aggressive behavior, because they're peeing on the floor, they're chewing, they're jumping, they're barking, they're digging. Very rarely will someone give up a dog because it's pulling them down the block or schlepping them along. So the bottom line is, what I wanted to do today was talk a little bit about how does a person find the right person. How do they know they have the right person when it comes to educating their own dog? Because right now, with all the shows on TV, you see all these people using these methods that I find atrocious, you know, flipping the dog on his back and telling the dog he can't go for a walk till you walk out of the door and not allowing your dog to sleep. All kinds of nonsense out there. So I'm glad I have you today. We're going to talk a little bit about the specifics of methods, because there's a lot of different methods of dog training. Some people approach it. I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but it's worth it. Years ago, I don't even know if he's still alive. I don't think he is. There was a trainer by the name of William Kohler. Bill Kohler was the head trainer for Disney Studios. And if you read Kohler's books, and I happen to meet him a few times, here's an example of what he suggests doing. This is the guy who trained Old Jello, okay? If you have a dog that's digging in your backyard, what you do is you dig a hole. You fill the hole with water. You stick the dog's head in the water till you see bubbles coming up, and then your dog will never dig another hole. Now, here's Warren's method, okay? If you have a dog that's digging in your backyard, let him dig. What I did is I went to Home Depot. I bought a kiddie pool. I filled it with sand and dirt. I buried his toys in there. I went in there and made believe I was digging to tease him. And now in my yard, that's where they go. They have their own little sandbox and place to go. So there's been a lot of training methods out there, and some of the new ones you see on TV, which I find abusive as well. As a trainer, and you know I'm not working as a trainer as much now anymore, and you are you finding that a lot of people are asking you, how come you're not tougher? Is there another way? So what approach do you take, Jeannie?
Yeah, I do find that. I just had a private client yesterday say to me, you never say no. And I mean, of course, sometimes I say no, but I don't lead with that because the dog would just get distracted. So I like to focus on leveraging the way they learn naturally, the science of learning theory, to positively show them what I'd like them to do and reward that, because the learning theory says that they're going to repeat what they are reinforced for.
You know, it's interesting that you said that. I was talking to someone, I think it was this week on the radio show, and one of the conversations we had is that he spends so much time telling his dog that he's doing something wrong that the dog actually is doing something wrong just to get that attention.
Right.
So I said to him, I said, here's what I would recommend that you do. When the dog is just hanging out, he's just sleeping in front of the fireplace like a Snoopy. Go over and tell him he's a good boy. Don't only tell him he's good when he does something right, and don't focus on all the negativity. Do you find that a lot of people spend more time telling their dog no? I often joke that I've gone into homes and said the word no when a dog comes thinking that's his name. But do you find that so many people focus on the negative more than the positive?
Yeah, they really want to go back to corrections, which is something that was popular in the 80s. How are you going to correct the dog? Well, how about you instruct the dog what you want it to do right in the first place? For example, jumping, supernatural behavior for dogs. They're just trying to get to your face. But a positive way to stop jumping wouldn't be to intervene physically during a jump. You would proactively teach the dog sit to greet and reinforce that. So the dog learns, oh, when I sit to greet someone, something good happens and I get to greet them, not waiting to punish and correct.
Well, it's like the person who takes their dog for a walk, and they take their dog for a walk, and they turn, the dog automatically turns into Cujo. He sees another dog, it's like he's ready to kill, he's ready to go. So what that person does, or what most trainers recommend that they do, is when the dog is pulling towards another dog in a so-called aggressive manner, more of a reactive matter than an aggressive matter. But if they're pulling, they jerk the dog back. They say, no, bad dog, fooey, what did you do? God knows what they're doing to the dog. And the bottom line is, if the dog is already having a negative association with the other dog, by you correcting the dog, it's going to make that animosity that much stronger and make it worse for next time. So how would you approach that? If someone were to say, Jeannie, listen, I love my dog. He's the perfect dog at night at 11 o'clock when I'm watching the news. However, when I take him outside, you know what? I call his name Nikki, and Nikki turns into Cujo. How would you approach that?
That is my favorite client to get. I love to heal the reactive dog, because you just go back to the basic learning theory. They learn by association and consequences. So what happens to them based on what they're looking at? If they're looking at a trigger slash the other dog or cat or whatever their trigger is, and they receive a punisher, for them, that dog created the punisher. So I like to back up and get them at a distance where they can learn and focus with me, and pair using classical conditioning, other dogs make something good happen. Now, I did that with my greyhound, Nikki, and he was a real tough case. He was probably the toughest case I ever saw, and now he can go to dog events. He sees dogs, and his default behavior now, he sees a dog, and he looks at me, checks in, and I reward that. And he doesn't associate dogs with anything negative anymore, because the gear that we wear, the equipment is really positive. I'm loose with him as far as not choking up and letting my energy get all jacked up on the leash. I try to stay really loose with him and show him other dogs make something good happen. And that's how the learning theory works. That's how they learn.
And don't you find, like, you know, I get this all the time, but I find that so many trainers out there are using the concept of, I'm not going to use the term negative reinforcement, though I probably could, but dominant training. You know, even years ago, and you know my background, I trained in Europe, Southeast Asia, and I worked with a lot of these macho guys, and they all wanted to dominate in the Shih Tzu training and Polizei Hund training, and I would be there, and a few black eyes later, you know, you get a lot more out of that, though. You can get him to go over that wall, maybe if you gave him a hug and a kiss when they got over, instead of telling him how bad he was for not going over. And I think so many people focus on the negative attention. I mean, I hear that all the time. Now, I'm not out in the field training as much as you are now, and I'm sure you're running across people and say, well, you know what? I saw this on TV, or you know, the guy that's training dogs over at Petco or PetSmart told me to do this. How much bad information is out there, and how much bad information are you dealing with being that you're actively training right now?
There is a ton out there, and I feel like in some ways it feels like it's getting worse, that negative training is becoming acceptable. People will let you do anything to their beloved animal in the name of training. And if I was a client, I would question why someone would be physically abusive to the dog that I love instead of just teaching them using a communication theory like clicker training or something like that, where it's fun, the dog thinks it's a game, and they're like, oh, we're playing clicker, I want to do that. But I feel that it is, I do get people who, you know, listen to Dr. Internet or whatever and want to train in an old school way, or they're reading old books or antiquated, you know, people using antiquated methods on television.
There are some horrendous methods and horrendous ideas on the internet. There are some great ideas on the internet,
yes,
especially on my website, but
right,
there are some horrible
and mine
and yours, but there are some horrible things out there. I mean, some of the things I hear about, I did a piece last week, and I think I posted it on my Facebook, and I talked about it on the radio show, and I want to talk about it right now. Almost every photograph I see lately is a dog wearing a prong collar, a spike collar, a pinch collar, whatever you want to call it. And I'm not talking about just large dogs. I'm talking about schnauzers, poodle, cockapoos. And I look at these people and I say to myself, you know, the reason it works is because it hurts your dog.
Yeah.
And then they always go, but it works. I said, yeah, but there's a better way to do that. You know, and so my approach has always been, and I took a lot of flack for this.
Yeah.
I do not believe and have never, and all ego aside, I personally have trained well over 40,000 animals, and I've never, ever used an electronic collar, a shock collar, because here's the difference, and I think you agree with me, and you may not. There's no such thing as a perfect dog.
I agree.
There's no such thing as a dog that's going to listen 100% of the time.
True.
I generally say if my dog's responding about 85% of the time, I'm a happy guy. That's the way it is.
Most humans don't listen that much.
50% of the time if we're lucky. But I always do this. I always tell people, you know, when you go into someone's home and they say to their dog, sit, and the dog looks up at them and say, you talking to me? Then I know I have a bright dog, and people always misinterpret, and bear me out of it, people misinterpret the intelligence of a dog for lack of intelligence, because the more difficult the dog is to train, the more intelligent they are. They're not going to accept it. It's like the bright kid, and you say, let's say I told you, Jeannie, right now to go out and wash my car. Never mind, I know what you would say to me. But the bottom line is there are certain dogs that would react the same way. In other words, you tell them to do something, and they're going to look and say, okay, why?
What's in it for me?
Exactly. What's in it for them? And if they don't do it, then they get corrected, which means they're not going to want to do it even more the next time rather than focusing on the positive.
Yep. And so I think that positive trainers need to continue to fight the fight and spread the word and show how powerful positive training is. Because quite frankly, when I work a reactive dog in the presence of something they're reactive to and I do it right, there's nothing to see.
Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing to see. But if you know, you can easily let the dog fail, go super threshold and, you know, lose their stuff. That's more exciting, I guess, for television. But my goal when I work a reactive dog is zero fails.
What would be some of the most difficult problems? For example, I know I get this all the time. A lot of people have difficulty housebreaking a dog. A lot of people have difficulty with a puppy that's chewing or a dog that's, you know, I get the calls, hey, Warren, my dog's 5 years old. When's he going to stop teething? I can break the news. He stopped teething 4.5 years ago.
Nice.
But those are the problems that cause people a lot of headaches and a lot of pain. From a housebreaking perspective, we may disagree, and that's fine, but I take a different approach. I don't use crates. I don't use kennels for training. Never have. And my theory behind that is that I would, first of all, no one told me to incarcerate my dog, and I have no desire to be the dog's warden. But besides that, I would rather gate off a small area and let the dog be good in that area and then increase the area a little bit at a time and decrease it if he's bad rather than go from a cage to the whole house.
Right. And take him out every hour and reward at the potty spot.
And people say, but my dog loves going in his crate, Jeannie. My dog absolutely adores his crate. Well, here's my theory. If you give the dog the opportunity, the option between a cage with a nice soft pad on it or a queen-size bed with fluffy pillows and a TV and a remote control, the dog's going for the TV and the remote control all the time.
Amen.
So I think it's important that the more time the dog spends with you in the environment, the less apt he is to want to destroy that environment.
Yeah, I think the crate thing can get overused as a management tool by people who are just worried about destruction and potty training and stuff because they're gone long hours.
And it's an avoidance approach. In other words, what are you teaching the dog by putting him in a cage? Are you teaching him not to chew?
No.
In some cases, you know, it does work. But I just find out that in many cases, I'll give you an example. The average person that I know works 8 hours a day. The average person that I know, other than me, sleeps 8 hours a day. So that's 16 hours. Throw in an hour for Kmart. That's 17 hours a day that dog is in a crate. Psychologically, the damage.
Yeah.
Physiologically, the dog's down on his hocks. He can't stand up. So I'm not a big believer in that. But I want to go over some of the other things. Housebreaking and chewing, for example. If I were to come to you as your client, I said, Jeannie, I love this little Papillon I have, but I only have left shoes. Every right shoe I've had is gone. He chewed every shoe. What would you do to help me resolve an issue like that?
Well, I would try to help that poor little Papillon be set up to be successful. If your shoes are everywhere and he's unattended, he's set up to fail. And so he's just learning. Everything's a chew toy. They don't have a value system on anything. So I'd probably have you put your shoes away out of the dog's long-term confinement area, wherever that may be, if the whole house or whatever it is, and fixate him, habituate him to an antler or something sustainable chew, a hoof, something like that.
Hoof is okay. I'm not, see, they put those around years ago. They put out the hoofs, they put out the
pig
antlers
ears.
And the pig ears. It looked like Jeffrey Dahmer opened the pet store. I mean, body parts all over the house. I'm fine. And look what they did with the bully sticks. People don't know what a, you know what a bully stick
oh,
is?
Oh, boy.
People have no idea what a bully stick. Well, just for you people out there, while you're enjoying your lunch and listening to Podcast One right here, a bully stick is the penis of a bull.
Yep.
I've been told it's low in fat. And it's good for the dogs to chew on. But that's what it is. I have some friends I'd love to send a package to be honest. But that's what it is. People have no idea. So from a chewing perspective, you would say more toys. Don't give the dog the opportunity to make some mistakes. See, that's what I like about you. A lot of trainers, what they want to do is have the dog make the mistake so they can correct the mistake rather than teach that there's no mistake to begin with.
Right. Here's what we do, and we do this, and we get reinforced. And they like to repeat what they're reinforced for, so that's the crux of it.
Here's my favorite. I love when someone says to me, Warren, here's what I do. My dog chews my shoes. And I said, what do you do when your dog chews your shoes? And I said, well, it's very simple. My trainer said, whenever I see the dog chewing a shoe, I take the shoe away, and I give the dog a toy of his own. What did you just tell the dog? Anytime you want a toy of your own, just go grab another shoe.
Back
You're reinforcing that behavior. People just don't think that way, and you hit the nail on the head when you use the term association. Describe that a little bit more to me.
Well, dogs do learn by association because they don't have language. And my training style, I tend to be a bit quiet. I don't chatter with the people or the dog when I'm actually working the dog because I know that dogs learn by association and consequences. They don't have that many words, and humans are kind of, you know, arrogant as far as, you know, talking with the words and their opposable thumbs, and we're all that in a bag of chips. But the dog is kind of like trying to find a thread of something meaningful. So by association, for example, this long skinny thing, fabric or leather, we know that's a leash, but to the dog, that's how you get out. You know,
exactly.
That leash gets a lot of meaning. And so it's the same thing if you left a piece of chicken down on the coffee table and the dog went over there and surfed that. He's going to look for chicken there all the time.
And you know, it's kind of what I like to I tell people when they're leaving the house. Dogs are intuitive. And as you said, they learn through the associative memory. And I'll talk about a study I did when I was studying at the University of Frankfurt. But the bottom line is, a lot of people, what they do is they leave the house the same way every day. They grab their jacket, they grab their purse, they grab their car keys, and they grab their attaché case. And as soon as the dog sees that, he knows
sequence
that you're going for a long period of time. It's not just out in the backyard to throw the garbage away. He knows that you're going for a long time. So one of the things I do is teach people not to do all that stuff. I literally had a client years ago that every time he left the house with his attaché case, before he got out the door, the dog would rip the attaché case. I used to laugh because the attaché case had all teeth marks all over.
How would you like to see
it? It got to the point, this before I got to train the dog, it actually got to the point where the guy would take a rope and drop his attaché case from his bedroom down to the ground and not take his attaché case out of the house. He would actually pick it up when he got outside and walk away.
Because of the meaning it
there
had.
You go. But that's exactly what people do. So they reinforce the bad behavior that rather than focus on the good behavior. And you hit the nail on the head. It's like the dog at the front door. A lot of times when you watch trainers now that say, listen, you have to walk out before you let the dog out. You know, you can't let the dog walk out first. You got to walk out. You're the alpha.
He's got an evil plan to dominate.
That's it. We're going to talk about this alpha later. But the bottom line is that when I take my dog for a walk, guess what? It's not my walk. It's my dog's walk. He's been waiting. He's crossing his legs all day till I got home. He wants to go outside and see that cute little schnauzer around the corner. So when I take my dog for a walk, it legitimately is his walk. I talk about this often, and I saw this just the other day again. Denise, I'll tell you, it drives me crazy. A man's walking his dog. The dog's peeing on the telephone pole. The dog's dragging the dog, saying, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And my response was, I would love to be behind that man at a urinal. I would with a leash on his neck saying, hurry up, let's get going, let's get going. People don't give their dogs the opportunity to really enjoy. There's so many things that they can enjoy in life.
Right, like smelling their environment. You know, that's their social media in effect. They want to go check their pee mail, you know, see who's been there, what did they eat, what can they find out about them. It's enrichment. Like, not everything a dog does has to be utilitarian for a human being.
Yeah, you heard me say this before that. You know, I get this all the time when people go to their dog park and they get really aggravated because their dog's sniffing the butt of another dog. And I explain to them, from your dog's point of view, that's Yahoo and Google.
Right.
That's surfing the web. In other words, all the information you your dog needs is there. You know, hormones, the food that's in the area, all of that stuff comes over there. And what happens is when someone sees their dog pulling to another dog and sniffing the butt, they pull the dog away. It's kind of like you're creating animosity. Let the dogs get to know. It's like a handshake. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. Sometimes we should just let them be dogs. And I use that analogy that you just said all the time where it's like, it's called walking the dog. It's the dog's walk.
Exactly. And let them enjoy it.
Yeah.
And the other thing that people do with separation anxiety, which absolutely amazes me, is when they come home and the dog has done something wrong,
right.
They yell, they scream, you know. You know what you did? Do you know what you did over there? You chewed that. Do you know what you did over there? Like, they're having this conversation. The dog's looking up at them. Like, what are you talking about?
And then the dog, they think the dog knows it was wrong. But in the science says it's an appeasement gesture.
It is. And but the other thing is that dogs do get embarrassed.
They do feel shame. They don't know why you're all jacked up.
Yeah,
they do feel shame. They probably went to potty 8 hours ago right after you left, so they're not even thinking about that.
We have, you know, we're gonna take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a lot more. I want to talk about the positive approach to training. That's number one. I also want to talk about reward and aggressive behavior, because aggressive behavior is a big problem, and I would say one of the things that I'm most proud of that I do is evaluating dogs at shelters and humanes. Not as much as I used to, but I did that for a lot of years. I would spend literally, you know, 12, 14, 16 hours a day in New York and Jersey going up and evaluating dogs that were destined to be put to sleep. And there was no reason any of these dogs had to be put to sleep. They were just misevaluated in a bad area. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk a little bit more about specifics. Jumping, chewing, barking, housebreaking, your dog hates your mother-in-law. whatever the problems you have, we'll get into those in a few minutes. A quick break right here on the Pet Insider on Podcast One. We'll be right back at you.
How would you like to listen to Shaq and Kobe talking to each other and healing their wounds? Or Bret Easton Ellis asking real personal questions and getting honest answers from Kanye West and Marilyn Manson? Or maybe Adam Carolla doing a little one-on-one with Bryan Cranston and Seth MacFarlane? Of course you would. That's why you need to become a Podcast One Premium member ASAP. Joining Premium gets you access to all those exclusive shows, plus 10,000 other archives filled with amazing moments from big names. You can give it as a gift for Mother's Day, to Mom, or even better, to yourself. So go to PodcastOne.com now and click on Join Premium, then prepare to dive in. Now, back to the Pet Insider with Warren Eckstein.
And we are back on the Pet Insider. I'm Warren Eckstein, your host. Before we get back to my good friend Jeannie Tuttle and talk about your dog's behavior, I wanted to share some news from around the world talking about animals. This one is absolutely amazing to me. You know, when a woman becomes pregnant and has a baby, she gets like a few months off for maternity leave. And I think now there isn't even, isn't there like a paternity leave where the husband gets some time off too? Well, now in England, you can take paternity leave, which means if you get a new dog, a puppy, or adopt an older dog, you can get up to 39 weeks of paid leave to take care of the dog. God, I'd never have to work. And so paternity leave is now available in the United Kingdom, and they say it's time for the United States to hop on board with the paternity train. It's not just because I want to stay home and cuddle on the couch with my new feline or my new dog. It really establishes a much better relationship. I'm all for it. Paternity for dogs, I say go ahead. How about this one? See, a dog poops on the ground. Where else is he going to poop, Warren? Of course he's going to poop on the ground. And you don't clean it up. And the neighbors are upset. What are you going to do about it? Well, they figured it out, because residents of the Fountain Home Retirement Home in Florida, which has been open for a year or so, has been policing pet owners, requiring every resident who moves in to have their dog's mouth swabbed for DNA testing. I am not making this like CSI, folks. This way, if there's any dog poop left on the property, the dog poop investigators, I guess that's what they would be called, would go there, take some of the dog poop, bring it to the laboratory, and if the DNA matches the DNA that your dog was swabbed with, $250 fine for you. And one more we got here. It's really kind of interesting. I love horses. I'm a big horse fan. I think horses are incredible animals. But horses get bored, too. So what did they develop now? Bluetooth. Yes, Bluetooth came out with Bluetooth headphones for horses. So you can put these up. You can put these headsets on the horses. And it says that they have specific listening likes. They don't like rock and roll. They don't like folk music. They don't like country music, but strictly classical music. And it says it really makes all the difference in the world in calming the horses down. So I'm a big believer in music for horses and dogs as well. So that's some music, some news from around the world. Absolutely interesting stuff. I should give you one more. Older people. If you're an older person, you're going to live longer if you walk your dog. And you're going to feel better. And a new study says that dog walking benefits older adults. This from the researchers at the University of Missouri. So we'll give you some news every week that's coming up. News you won't hear on Nightline, I promise. We're talking to my good friend Jeannie Tuttle. We're talking about surviving your pet. And basic training is critical. And when we talk about basic training, I think, Jeannie, most people assume it's heel, sit, stay, down, come. Some people use go to place, the automatic sit. By the way, do you know why dogs were taught to walk on the left side?
No.
Okay. I see a lot of people never know these things. See, I have all this knowledge that no one needs to know.
It's coming out right and left.
Years ago, when first were originally trained, when dogs were originally being trained for the Roman empires, the mastiff dogs, most men are right-handed. So most men carried their weapons in their right hand. So the dogs were always taught to walk on the left side to be away from the weapon. And including, you know, Lhasa Apso, the small dogs? One of my favorite dogs. Only a Lhasa Apso is like living with a big dog dressed in a giant suit. The Lhasa was used as an alarm dog in Tibet. What they would do is, because they have the keenest sense of hearing of any dogs, so what they would do is, when they heard some intruders coming up, the Lhasas would start barking, then run home, and the big masters would come out and take care of the problem. All right, so let's get back to some specifics here. Heel, sit, stay, down, come. I always tell people it's the doggy alphabet. I'm not teaching it to the dog because I care if he sits every time I tell him, but it just gives me a positive way to communicate with the pet. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And, maybe you don't do this, but professional dog trainers, like I just got a new dog from the animal shelter.
Well, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, and her name's Penny, and she was 92 pounds. She was a lab rat, so she needed to get – anyway, she's not 92 pounds now, but – long story short is, I haven't really started training her yet because it's just kind of the way we live together. Like, she already has a default sit for everything, and that's kind of what we use. And I was thinking, I'm kind of lazy as a professional trainer. I should maybe put a few more skills on her.
Yeah, we were joking earlier. It's like the shoemaker's shoes that needs the heels, you know. But the problem is the family structure.
Yeah.
All right, let's say you get a new dog. All right, you know what you're doing, and your dog's going to be absolutely fine. There's no doubt in my mind. He's just watching you. But, and dogs... dogs know how knowledgeable the people they're with are. And I don't mean it's egotistical, but I'm sure the same thing happens to you and the same thing happens to me. I get called into a client's home years ago, and I'd walk into the client's home, and their hair was standing up like Kramer on Seinfeld. The dog was driving them absolutely crazy, doing everything wrong. Everything the dog could possibly do wrong, he was doing wrong. And yet, for whatever reason, they couldn't figure out what to do about it. They had no idea where to go, what to do. The trainer would come in, and the trainer would be tough on the dogs. But what the trainer didn't take into consideration is that the average dog that we work with doesn't live by himself.
No.
He lives with mom, pop, 2.5 kids, throwing grandma, grandpa.
Friends.
And after college, the kids moving back into the house again, right? That's what's going on. So now you have the husband telling the dog, jump up. You have the wife telling the dog, get down. You have the kids and the grandparents telling the dog something entirely different. That's when the dog dials the phone and says, Warren, they're driving me crazy. Isn't this the definition of neurosis? So when you go into a home, and I want everyone out there listening today, I want you to understand this, because you're going to be facing these problems. One of the most difficult things for any trainer or behaviorist to do is try to establish some type of continuity within the home. In other words, if one person tells the dog to come and the dog doesn't come, and that person goes and watches TV, then the dog's not going to know whether he should come every time or not. So how do you deal with the people? Isn't that probably the biggest part?
It really is training those two-leggeds, but they want to learn or they wouldn't be hiring us. You know, they have motivation too. But basically, I try to get everybody on the same page. And every time a new client calls and says, well, should my husband and my whole family be there for the first session? I was like, always say, absolutely. The more we're all on the same page, speaking the same language, the better. You know, a real common one, people, if they don't want their dog on the couch for whatever reason, they keep saying down, and I would change that just to off in case you want to use down for lie down.
As a command,
and, you know,
exactly.
And just try to be consistent with the words you use after the words have meaning.
That's like using the word no with a dog named Mo.
Yeah,
do it, man. And I've heard that, believe me. I've heard people do that. So from a training aspect, let's go into a specific for a while. Let's deal with separation anxiety.
Okay,
you hear me talk a lot, and I know you listen to my show. You hear me talk a lot about the difference between separation anxiety and abandonment issues. Abandonment issues, from my perspective, are the dogs that have been at the shelter, adopted, gone back to the shelter, been adopted, gone to a foster home, back to a shelter, Now into another home. And the difference between separation anxiety and abandonment issues, they're similar, but the dog that has abandonment issues just assumes that every time you leave, you're not coming back, because it's happened to him so many times before. And as you said, Jeannie, they learn through association. So when dealing with separation anxiety and abandonment issues, what would be the first thing you would advise your clients to do? Because I would say that nowadays, you know, we're kind of living in a latchkey pet society. Mm-hmm. Mom and dad are both working, the kids are off at soccer, and our dogs are being left alone. And I've always said this, it's not the quantity of time you spend with your pet that's important. It's the quality. So how do you deal with separation anxiety?
I back up and try to work with the human to let them, the pet owner, let them know that they need to teach the dog how to be alone. It's not a natural skill for the dog. So if you get your dog from the shelter on Friday night and you want to start, you're going to have to go to work on Monday or Tuesday, on Saturday you need to spend that time not on a bunch of other skills like sit and down and come, but showing the dog what your leaving cues are. I grab my cell phone, I grab my keys in my purse, and give the dog something positive to do so that he associates, oh, every time she leaves, I get a stuffed Kong. And that you actually set up deliberate training trials where you give the dog a positive thing, you leave, but you come back before the dog is fearful or anxious. So you literally, I do this with mine, you know, a minute, and you come back and you ignore the dog for a second, just put your stuff down. They need to learn that you come and you go, and it's totally normal. And then you do more trials over that weekend where you come and go for longer periods of time. And it's always best if you can come back before the dog kind of loses it, if you know, before they launch adrenaline and cortisol and fear-based hormones, so that they're still involved with a stuffed bone or a Kong or something like that. And you come back and you don't make a big drama out of it. Just, you know, be cool. You're going to come and go, and they need to be able to cope with it.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I always recommend is, because we were joking during the break that my next book's going to be All Dogs Are Jewish and Went to Catholic School because they make us feel so guilty. And the reason I bring that up is because guilt is part of it. Because nowadays, with the average person that is working 8 hours a day, when they come home, they feel so guilty that they left their dog that they spend the next 8 hours on top of their dog, the Velcro dog scenario, which I understand. That's what I want to do. And what I recommend that people do is, even when they come home and they've said hello to their dog and whatever, spend a few minutes, go into another room and close the door. Let the dog realize that even though you're there, he's not going to be on top of you all the time.
Exactly.
And little by little, building up that self-confidence is really, really important.
And then you can maul him about 10 minutes later.
There you go. Come back out and jump on top of him.
But not right associated to walking in the door. That'll make him nuts.
All right. Now, last week, Stanley Coren. Are you familiar with Stanley Coren?
Yes.
I've had my bouts with Stanley over the years. Stanley is a professor of behavior at the University of British Columbia. He recently came out with an article based on his opinion, mind you, and I think two dogs, that dogs hate to be hugged. They don't like to be hugged. Now, my entire reputation is based on hugging and kissing. And when I put this on Facebook, most of the people agreed with me. Warren, my dog loves to be hugged. Are there dogs that don't like to be hugged? Absolutely. I got to be honest with you, and it's not about being homophobic. I grew up in New York, and my father never hugged me. He would shake my hand, but never hugged me. When I would meet my friends, my age category, we would shake hands. Now, I'm living in California. Everywhere I go and I meet somebody, I get a hug, and I get a kiss. Man, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. So it's okay, and I've adapted to it. But there are certain dogs that don't like being hugged, and you need to take that into consideration, correct?
Yeah, I agree. I have one of each. Nikki, my greyhound, when I approach him, and he's just so cute, I can't not go over to him. But sometimes I watch, and if he turns his head away or yawns or something, which he does do, I was like, oh, he doesn't want to interact right now. He's not giving consent. My new dog, Penny, she sits there like a giant walrus, and she's just so huggable, like a big Buddha. And I hug her real quick, and I come off, I unhug her, and I see what she does. She leans toward me and gives me a paw. She wants to interact. So what I would like to see people get more in tune with on the street with strange dogs is the dog's allowed to have consent. Dogs don't have to just take strangers coming up and roughing their hair up.
Exactly. You know,
look for consent.
Every time I approach a dog, I say to the person, is it okay? I always ask.
Yeah.
You know, and then you have these trainers. I love these trainers that walk around with scars all over their bodies. Look at the scars on my... Yes, I do have a few scars, but it's not from dogs. One's from a mongoose, one's from... whatever. And the bottom line is that my feeling has always been, if you're so good, you shouldn't have that many scars on your body. It should be fun. And I think that's what's so important about the approach you take and the approach I take. And, you know, I deal with a lot of different trainers and behaviorists. And the reason I wanted to talk to you is because we've spoken before. And I know that your heart is in what you do. And so many people now, it's kind of an ego thing. I want to be a dog trainer. I'm going to go to this school. I'm going to go to that school. I'm going to take this. And so many dogs still continue to wind up at shelters because of mistakes made by trainers and behaviorists. That's why I think it's equally as important when you're looking to find a trainer or find someone to work with your dog, it's important to get references as if that trainer was going to be the pediatrician for your child.
Yeah, because there are a lot of people doing all kinds of crazy things to dogs, and there are some credential systems that, like, the Leaders in Positive Training got together and put a credential around positive training that they're not vested in, and so it's independent, so it means more. And I find it to be very humbling when I do continuing education, because I don't know everything, and you got to keep trying to learn from people who know more than you.
How important is it educating the children? Because I know that, you know, lots of times with adults, you can't change their mind. But if you can get there and educate kids in terms of humane behavior and the fact that, you know, when you're upset, you cry and you feel bad, well, your dog or your cat does that as well. How important is it to educate the kids and really get that generation into it? And I think we're doing a good job of that, doing that.
Yeah, I think it's great. I volunteer at a shelter in Ventura County, Ventura County Animal Services, and they have a lot of programs where the kids will collect up money. Instead of having a birthday party where they play games, they do donations for the shelter.
Oh, what a great
idea. There's all sorts of things where you see children reading books to shelter pets so that they get confidence about their reading skills, and the shelter pet gets to have that interaction with the children.
It's so important from a socialization point of view. And, you know, when you look at the dogs at the shelters, very often, we're going to talk about greyhounds in a bit, but when you look at the dogs at the shelters or animals that have been abused or for whatever reason, you can see in their eyes that they're fearful, they're afraid, they're devastated, and very often that's misinterpreted as aggressive behavior. And it's just... breaks my heart, and actually brings tears to my eyes when I think about how many thousands or tens of thousands of dogs are killed every single year in this country because they're misevaluated. Even my own little Cisco, he was part of a hoarding case out of Acton, California with 200 chihuahuas. They were at the Baldwin Park shelter, which is a shelter here in Los Angeles, and they were deemed all aggressive by behaviors from San Francisco, who I admire what they do up there, and they were all going to be killed. Well, they asked me if I would come in and evaluate the dogs. Not the shelter. Someone else asked me. And I went there and I evaluated the dogs. And, yeah, they chewed me up a little bit, you know, but they were chihuahuas. The worst bite would be a hangnail. And to prove my point, I picked up Cisco, which was one of the more aggressive ones, and I held him in my chest. And Cisco's now my dog. And we found homes for the majority of other dogs. But every one of these dogs was deemed aggressive and had, I don't want to sound egotistical, but had I not gone in there and taken on the county, which doesn't like me, by the way, and taken on the other behaviorists, 200 dogs would have been killed, including my own Cisco, who is now just an amazing dog.
Yeah, I mean, it's most of it is just fear. And once you can get past the fear, you know, you can see the dog underneath.
And the one thing I would like to see is more trainers and behaviorists volunteering some time to work with shelters. But the problem is I don't think the shelters want us there. I think for some reason they're kind of skeptical about having trainers and behaviorists coming in because it might make them look bad. A couple of more quick questions for you. In terms of tools, okay, and the tools of a trainer, okay, there are many different tools. We have the choke collar, which, by the way, I don't call it a choke collar. I call it a training collar because, you know, I used it years ago in Europe, and if it's used correctly, it can be okay. You have the martingale-type collars.
Yeah.
You have the harnesses. You have the one that goes over the dog's face.
Gentle leader.
You have the gentle leader. The halter, I think, has another
yeah.
name. You have, I've seen, you know, the no-pull halters. You know those?
Yeah.
You know who developed those, right? Whose idea was that?
Really?
I developed them years ago for a company called Four Paws.
Nice.
Many, many years ago. And it was a harness that really works well with dogs if it's used properly. Some of the other tools are the prong collars, the electronic shock collars, and the no-pull harnesses. What do you recommend? Now, different dogs obviously need different things, okay?
Sure.
Prong collars, electronic shock collars, as far as I'm concerned, should be illegal.
I agree. I don't use any positive punisher because I think I should respect the dog and teach it what I want it to do instead of being violent.
And the training collar, or what's called the choke collar, what people don't understand about that collar when it's used correctly is that it's not the collar that's the correction. It's the sound that's the correction. For example, are you familiar with something called a throat chain?
Oh, my gosh, yeah, from a long time ago.
Oh, come on, you're making me feel old now,
dude. Throat chain
was something that was used for off-lead training. It's still used for Shih-Tzu training.
I know.
It's a little chain you hold in your hands. And when you're working with a dog off-leash, because you used a regular chain, the dog associates a sound, you can rattle that chain in your hand or toss it on the ground, and the dog responds to it. Not necessarily if you're a really good trainer. But the bottom line is, with some really advanced training, the type of Shih-Tzu training where a dog has to stop on a dime before it hurts somebody, I can understand a little bit more of that type of training. But I'm a firm believer in totally non-assertive training. If your dog doesn't want to learn how to catch a frisbee, teach him how to swim.
Right. Stop trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
That's just a great way to put it. It's because I get people call me, oh, listen, I have this schnauzer, and I want this dog to guard my auto body shop. Sorry.
I'd like to lose weight on a pizza diet, okay?
There you
that
go.
Just ain't how it works.
It's not going to happen. So from a perspective, you use like what kind of collar do you prefer?
My go-to piece for a dog that pulls is a front connecting harness, which kind of negates the desire to pull in a really humane way. That or just a buckle collar. I like to teach the dogs to target to my hand or whatever, so you can actually position the dog into a heel by teaching them to come and target to your hand, and you don't have any physical force necessary. I was working with a lady yesterday who had a stroke, and there's no way she could do some of the physical stuff you would have to do with old school like jerk and choke stuff, so we're teaching the little Frenchie to come and touch a target when he pulls out. She stops and he targets, and then they move together.
And it's so easy to do. You know, years ago, I trained the first dog for seizure control. It was a dog in Massachusetts, and a woman had. I was the head instructor at that point for Assistance Dogs International. And what had happened is there was no one doing that type of work. And so this woman had passed out several times, and they thought she was either a junkie or an alcoholic. So we taught the dog, and he wore a special harness and a special vest, that when she did pass out or have a seizure, he would stand on top of her. And we used a golden retriever. I wanted to use a shepherd. And the reason we didn't use a shepherd is people are less apt to approach a shepherd than they would be a golden or a Labrador.
Yeah.
And she had several seizures, and the dog saved her life. So it's just amazing the things that we can teach them if we just took the time to look at life from their point of view.
Yeah.
Too many trainers assume that it's us. They have to do it the way we want to do it. You know me, I'm always down on my hands and knees. And that's the name of the game. You've got to get down to their level to really understand them.
And that's kind of one of the things I really love about the newer sport of canine nose work is it is this obedience-free zone. It is not about obedience at all whatsoever in the way that I'm taught to teach it. We are learning from the dog how scent works for the dog. When they hit the edge of an odor cone, they're going to snap their head, and you can see, oh, that must be where it was. And it's I have had people say when I talk about nose work, well, what do I do with that? And I just say, well, it's not about you.
Exactly.
It's for your dog.
You know, I always thought there are certain dogs that need a job. And in terms of nose work, you know, my specialty for many, many years was teaching dogs to sniff out incendiary devices and narcotics. And I was joking with Tommy Chung a couple of weeks ago that I knew where the bombs were to stay away, but I also knew where the drugs
were. Right.
I was just a joke, Tommy Chung, I promise. But the bottom line is that the ability of a dog's olfactory is shocking.
Yeah.
I can tell you every part about it, but the bottom line is I still am amazed. Yeah, I'm going to tell a quick story, then we'll move on. Years ago, I was working with a dog. Remember Woolworths? Anyone remember Woolworths?
I do.
Okay, well, those people old enough out there that remember Woolworths. I was training the original Mrs. Woolworth's dog.
Wow.
I went into her home on Fifth Avenue, New York City. It was like a Betty Davis movie. She answered the door with white gloves, the butler, the whole thing. Her complaint was her dog was only chewing her right shoes, not left shoes, only her right shoes. Now, I'm pretty good, but I'm trying to figure out what's going on, why the right shoe, not the left shoe. It was driving me crazy. It turned out that after a while, she had gone to a podiatrist, and it turned out she had a cancerous tumor on the right foot, the shoes the dog was chewing on. So it just amazes me. And now we know they're being used to diagnose diseases.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah. There's so much more that we don't know.
Okay, so now if people want to find out more about you and get in touch with you, then go to your website. What is that?
My website is www.doggenie.com. That's DOGGENIE.com.
And you won't hear me endorse or recommend too many trainers. Now, there's a lot of them out there, but you're one I do. We've known each other for a long time now, and I love the work you do. Now, let's move away from training for a second.
That means
Let's go to rescue.
Oh, yeah.
In the studio with us today, and if I knew how to use a camera, you know, this is true. I have a beautiful camera in the studio. Am I right, Kevin? There's a camera in the studio, a nice camera, Sony, good one.
Yeah,
can't
totally.
Can't use it, though. You know why?
Why's that?
Because, you know, if it doesn't pee, I don't deal with it.
That's his motto.
That's his limitation.
That's my limitations. So let's talk about, otherwise I'd show you a picture. I brought that up because we have this beautiful greyhound rescue dog, Nikki. I know Nikki for a lot of years now. Nikki has a bit of a deformed face.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Nikki's rescue.
Well, we got Nikki from, I think he came, he had 26 races at the Tucson Greyhound
So he was a greyhound racing dog.
He was a racing greyhound, and he came into our rescue, and I'm on the board of Homestretch Greyhound Rescue and Adoption, and he came in, and, you know, he was very hard to reach, very scattered, very distracted, and we saw that there was a giant lump in his nose. His nose is crooked from some genetic defects, but there also was this lump. So we did the x-ray and found that he had a tooth in his sinus cavity.
Wow.
And he was in tremendous pain just living his life at the track with this tooth up there. So we actually took it right out the side. He's got a little scar on the side of his nose, and then voila, new dog.
But let's, you know, if you were to look at, cover his ears, will you? If you were to look at Nikki, people would be afraid of him.
Yeah, because one of his eyes is kind of in front of the other, and his bottom teeth stick out, and his face is deformed, and he's large, and he's black.
Exactly, and there's a whole we'll talk about that in a future show, this black dog syndrome, which is a big problem. So let me ask you about greyhounds in general. You know, when I first started, I remember doing a segment on the Today Show where I had, I think it was 40 or 50 greyhounds on with me at one time. It was just an incredible segment. I was working with GPA at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of greyhounds. I just absolutely love them. The problem with greyhounds is they're like potato chips. You can't just have one.
No, you got to have two.
And when you rescue a greyhound off the track, very often, you know, they've never seen a mirror. They've never seen a TV. They've never heard a radio. They've never had a pat on the head. They've never been hugged. They've never been kissed. They've just never been exposed to anything. And at one point when I started, it out, 60,000 greyhounds were being killed every year between 2 and 4 years old just because their racing career was over, or they didn't like them when they were first born in the litter, or they didn't like the way they looked, or whatever. It's just incredible, just absolutely amazing thing to me. Now, that's getting better. A lot of the tracks are closing around the country,
yes.
And that's a great thing.
It is.
You work with the Greyhound Rescue.
Yeah.
And with Greyhound Rescue, are you finding that the owners of these dogs are now giving them up more easily than they did years ago?
From the tracks?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're really trying hard to form some sort of relationship for the good of the dogs to get them homes, and so that they have an avenue after they're done instead of being terminated.
Which is great. And there are so many greyhounds out there for adoption right now. I just did a piece not too long ago with a greyhound rescue in just outside of Sedona, Arizona. Amazing group of people. You know the greyhound tracks in Arizona. They closed the one, I believe, in I'm trying to think of where it was. My mind is going black. But they closed one that it drives me crazy driving past it every day. And it's closed, but it's like the ghosts of wonderful dogs.
Turn it into something else. You know?
Make it into a rescue.
Right?
Wouldn't that be the perfect thing to do?
That would be great. But greyhounds are just wonderful. Once they learn what their new role is, they just soak it up. Talk about wanting to be hugged, greyhounds.
Talk about Velcro dogs.
Yeah.
You know, dogs that want to be with you all the time. Yeah. So Homestretch Greyhound Rescue, a great group of people. I've worked with you guys before. No matter what part of the country, what part of the world you live in, you're listening to the podcast, there are greyhound rescues all over the country. And you should consider adopting a greyhound. They're super duper dogs. They just really, really are. And very easy to train.
And we're taking the fight international. There's tracks to be closed in Australia, and if you look at Grey 2K USA, they have a listing of where
I love the Australian greyhounds that come here. They run around the backyard the opposite way.
Yeah, right.
So greyhounds are just amazing dogs. I'm really pleased that you're doing a lot of rescues. A lot of people in our profession, what they're involved with is making a living training dogs. I said this last week on the podcast, and I'm going to say it again, is that I was always brought up that whatever you receive, you have to give back. And I was talking about the fact that I made a really good living for a lot of years training a lot of celebrity dogs. We talked about that last week from some of the most affluent people in the country. But at the same time, I would spend 2 or 3 days a week in the South Bronx or Brooklyn or the worst neighborhoods training dogs for free for people that have adopted or senior citizens or people who are just down on their luck or homeless men and women as well. So it's an incredible thing that you do. And I know you do a lot of volunteer work as well. Before we end it, and Homestretch Greyhound Rescue, go to their website as well.
Yep, homestretchgrays.org.
Okay. So before we end this, I just want to ask you one more thing that's really, really important, okay? Why should people have their dogs? I'm even afraid to use the word trained anymore, educated. why is it important? In other words, is it important because of our ego or is it important because of the safety? And is the working with, if you're training a dog properly and you're working with the dog properly, there's a symbiotic relationship that establishes between the trainer and the dog. No one who hasn't worked with dogs consistently doesn't understand what I'm saying. Right. And I know you do. But there's a symbiotic relationship that establishes between the dog and the trainer. And I think that's what makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah, basically, you should have your dog be trained up a little bit so that they can stay in the living room and out of the shelter. And what if something happened to you and your dog, you were living with your dog who was a wild wild beast and it was fine with you, but maybe the next person, you know,
or
wouldn't
you had to go to
the
hospital or something were to happen.
Yeah,
to you.
It's just put some basic skills and manners on, and it gives all the dog owners a nice reputation out in the community. And so you can take more dogs places to restaurants and things like that, the more well behaved they are too, as ambassadors.
I would much rather be at a restaurant with a bunch of dogs than some of the people I was there with the other day. Let me tell you that. Gina, I want to thank you for being here. We're gonna have you back again. It's kind of, you know, we'll do tips from time to time on training. One of the trainers that I really admire, endorse, and have a lot of faith in, we've worked together before, I've known her. Again, your website, Jeannie?
DogGeannie.com.
That's easy enough, DogGeannie.com, or you can go to my website, ThePetShow.com. Coming up in the next few weeks, we have some interesting podcasts coming up here. We have a Shark Tank. We're going to be talking about some brand new items that are on the market. We have Tony Tenniel coming up. I'm ashamed of you, Kevin. Ashamed that you don't know who Toni Tenniel is. The Captain and Tenniel. Muskrat love. Come on.
She's awesome.
She is awesome. Anyway, Toni Tenniel will be joining us in the not-too-distant future. And we got a lot of great segment ideas. We also have a segment coming up, which is not so much on dogs and cats. It's on world wildlife rescue and saving animals from around the world. So we have that coming up. What else do I have coming up, Denise? I know I have more coming up.
Feline Freud.
Oh, Feline Freud. I did a segment a couple of years ago in New York City. It was myself and someone else you don't know, Kevin, the amazing Kreskin. The amazing Kreskin and myself did a, and Kat Cora, the famous chef Kat Cora, still nothing. I'm telling you, it's not easy working with the staff here. Anyway, we're gonna be talking about a lot of things in Feline Freud. A lot of people don't understand that cats can be trained. I remember one of the first David Letterman shows I did. I was training his dogs, and Dave said to me, "Warren, you're crazy. You can't train a cat." I said to him, "Dave, watch me." 2 weeks later, I brought my cat on the David Letterman show. I keep saying that David Letterman was at late night with David Letterman at that point. And I came out and I had Maudy, which was my cat, a feral cat that I had rescued, sit at one end, come to me when I called her, lie down, roll over, and Dave never said another word to me about cats not being able to be trained. It's
awesome.
That simple. Anyway, I thank you all for listening. You've been listening to The Pet Insider here on Podcast One. You can also find Podcast One. You can download and get the podcast every week, or you can go to iTunes. It's available there as well. Thank you for joining me. We'll be back next week. No, we won't be back next week. We will be back next week. I will be here every week. You can't get rid of me. Next week is Shark Tank. Should be a lot of interesting. Till then, give all your pets a big hug and a kiss for you. A special hug and a kiss right between the ears for me. I'm Warren Eckstein. You've been listening to The Pet Insider here on Podcast One.
Thanks for listening to The Pet Insider. Download new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com or subscribe now on the Podcast One app.